You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. A few of you have been writing in to tell me that these intros are getting a little too long. I completely understand, and I hear you, so I'm going to make this short and sweet for you. Today's episode is all about Gesneriads, and joining us to talk about them is member of the Gesneriad Society, Jay Sespico. Jay is a hobby grower and a lover of all things Gesneriad. Now, if you're not familiar with Gesneriads, you probably are and don't realize it. Gesneriaceae is the family that gives us African violets and myriad other species, as you're going to find out. Now, Jay specializes in growing and breeding a handful of these plants, specifically those in the genus Gesneria, Coleria, Nautilocalyx, Pimulina, and Syningia. Before we get to this conversation, I just want to remind everyone that if you're interested in Gesneriads and you live in the greater Massachusetts area, the Gesneriad Society is having their big convention, which is coming up July 3rd through the 7th, which I'll put links to on the episode page, but you can just find all of that information by Googling Gesneriad Society. All right, everyone, without further ado, here is my interview with Jay Sespico. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, good.
We're doing it, man.
Yeah, we're on. Okay,
excellent.
Go.
All right. Well, Jay Sespico, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Okay. My name is Jay Sespico. I work for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. I am a civilian in the capacity of a master control operator, which means that I am the dispatcher for the jail. And I have been growing Gesneriads all my life, which is getting to be longer the more longer I live. So, but I've been interested in plants even as a kid, even as a little kid. So I have a degree in horticulture from vocational school here in Florida, Pinellas Vocational Tech. And so I've been working at the sheriff's office, growing Gesneriads and many other things as well.
Very cool. Okay, so you said you've always been interested in plants, but was it always from a horticultural perspective, or, you know, what kind of got you going with botany and then into plants, and then how did you segue into growing plants?
Well, I think it was my Aunt Edna. My mother's oldest brother had a wife that loved to grow plants, and we lived in Buffalo when I was a kid, and the Buffalo winters were very long and gray.
Indeed they are.
But I would go over to my Aunt Edna's house, and she loved to grow succulents. I think she just loved succulents because they were so geometric and they were so interesting to her. She grew Sansevieria and Echeveria and some cactus. And I would go into her sun porch, and the plants were against the snow. It's just hard to explain, but it was full of light, and it was bright, and it was warm. And it was just so cool. I think I just learned to love plants from my Aunt Edna. That was, man, I hate to tell you how long ago that was, but that was in the era when plants were kind of cool. You could walk into any Five and Dime and buy a foliage plant, a friendship plant, a peperomia, or something like that. So what actually got me started growing plants was prayer plants.
Oh.
And I don't know the name of this one, but this is the kind of plant
beautiful
that got me going in horticulture, because it moved. Because the leaves, they fold down during the day, and at night they completely fold up. That's what got me started.
That's awesome. I love, Maranta is such a great introduction for many people because the foliage is gorgeous. They're relatively forgiving. And like you said, they're kind of dynamic for a houseplant, which is not really what you expect. Yeah. If you want to grow plants, you don't expect things moving around very much.
I was just absolutely fascinated by the whole thing because I never thought plants could move on their own. It never occurred to me that they can. Of course, you know, then you learn about things like tropisms and, you know, geotropism, phototropism, all that kind of stuff. So.
Sure. And I mean, I'm always curious about how, what that hook is, because like you said, plants were, there was a houseplant craze a while back. It's starting again today. And, you know, there's all these ideas of plant blindness, and people just don't recognize plants or think they're kind of these static, boring things that just sit on a corner and maybe you look at them and water them every once in a while. But finding out what hooks people is always really fascinating, because you never know what it's going to be. And it usually just takes that one thing for you to start paying attention to plants, and then they do the rest for you.
Yeah, they do. And that's exactly what happened. And so I went to horticulture school, and then I expanded, and it's just an incredible, much, much larger part of my life than I probably meant it to be.
As a collector and an obsessive personality myself, I completely empathize with you. And I also empathize with the fact that being a fellow Buffalonian, growing up, being able to look at a green plant in the windowsill while you're covered in 3-4 feet of snow, it's so therapeutic.
It is. It was very therapeutic. And that was very therapeutic to me, because Buffalo was not a good time when I only stayed there really till I became a young adult. And mm-hmm. then we moved to Florida, which was great.
So, okay, the reason we got into contact was because you are part of the Gesneriad Society. And, of course, you're here to talk today about your obsession with Gesneriads. When did that start? How did that start? And what did it start with?
Well, you know, it's kind of a tapestry that's woven itself in and out of my life many times. My mother had a friend Ann Hansen, who used to grow beautiful violets on her sun porch on top of her chest freezer. And they were absolutely in bloom all the time. They were just incredible. She just was a great gardener and a great grower. So I got interested in violets from seeing her. And, you know, of course, they're very easy to propagate, and that was okay. So then between horticulture school and making my career in horticulture, I kind of gave that up for a while and came back to violets. And I noticed that our local club shared some members with the Gesneria Society. And then it wasn't just these wonderful little rosette plants anymore. It was a whole new world. It was really cool. And there are so many different kinds of, there's a Gesneriad for everyone. There's so many genres. It's a very large plant family. I joined the Gesneriad Society, which is an international society devoted to the education and propagation and spreading the fun of growing Gesneriads. So that, then it was the end. That was the end of the, it was the beginning of the end.
So often I talk to people that get into groups, specific groups of plants, especially in terms of growing them, and that is always how they explain it. It's the beginning of the end, because there's times, and I just did it this weekend, where you step back and you go, oh, what have I done to myself? Why did I, oh man, I have no space left.
I've been through other genera. I went through the succulents. I went through, you know, the prayer plant, aglaonema kind of things. I was into orchids for a long time, and I studied with a judging group that's here in Tampa, the AOS group. And but that is a commitment of time that I could not do. It's that was years and years and years.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Gesneriads are the things that have stuck, and they're very forgiving. Many of them are rhizomatous and tuberous. So if I occasionally dry them out like a desert, I can recover them.
Going back to your succulent days, coming back from it. And that's cool. And like you said, it's a diverse group. There's a plant in there somewhere for everyone. And so often, all most people get to see or realize are Gesneriads are the African violets, which is really kind of the gateway drug, so to speak, into this group for most people.
Yeah,
but it goes so far beyond that. And when you start to learn about these plants, you realize, oh, that weird vine in the botanical garden, that's a Gesneriad. And that strange bulbous thing with this woody stem that looks like a corm, that's a Gesneriad too. When you realized that, where did you go? What were some of your first attempts? Who were some of your first plants that you were introduced to and really started to have success with?
Well, you know, in Florida, Matt, Epeisha was a really great thing. It's, you know, Epeisha is a plant that you just can't help but love.
Yeah.
And in Florida, it does really well. Now, in other climates, it would not have been my gateway plant. But here in Florida, the humidity is high enough, even with the air conditioner on in the summertime, that it does very well, and they have just beautiful foliage, wonderful foliage, and beautiful red and orange and yellow flowers. which is very different. Violets really don't have a lot of really true reds. Well, the yellows are kind of buttery yellow. Mm. You kind of have to use your imagination, yeah. You know. But the peaches are great. And so that got me going. And then I think the very next thing that I kind of got interested in was probably Collyrias. Collyrias are also red and bright. The petals have spots. I just thought that was the coolest thing that I had ever seen. The ones that I'm sorry that I got into is Nautilus calyx, because Nautilus calyx has gone through a terribly severe reclassification. So everything I once thought was a Nautilus calyx really turned out to be a Chrysothemis or a Trichodrimonia or something like that. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you're someone who likes collections, sometimes those taxonomic revisions can really throw a wrench.
Yeah,
into,
it really messes you up.
regardless, you still have the plants, you're enjoying them, and I'm really happy you brought up Apicius, because I too started off with those, because you get the best of both worlds. You get a plant with stunning foliage, gorgeous patterning, nice and fuzzy, and then you get those amazing, just jaw-dropping flowers, but I struggled. I started off the hobby thinking everything wanted a heavy, nutrient-rich mix with tons of, you know, just heavy stuff. And then this past year, I got to go down to Costa Rica and see Apicius growing in the wild, and there they were climbing on rocks and stumps, and I went, oh, that's where I've been failing at these things. So they're not necessarily the plant you want to get, or you don't want to just jump in and go, well, whatever works for my Pothos is going to work for my Apicius or my Collyrias, right?
That's right. That's right. Chesnarians are very neutral, especially the ones that are American, from the American continent. Topography is usually karst, like we have here in Tampa. Mm-hmm. They really grow in very nutrient poor conditions. And they like a very, you know, it's just amazing what little they need, just some substrate, very shallow. And Mother Nature takes care of the rest, and they, you know, they don't need to be fed all that much. One of the major hurdles I had to get through was I would love my plants to death. I would lovingly water them and over-fertilize them, and they would die promptly, you know, and from the generosity of my plant friends. You know, they would always replace them for me. So they don't need a lot of fertilizer. They do need, you know, kind of consistent care, but...
Yeah, and that's the flavor of the various genera and even some of the species within it is what makes kind of getting into this specialty realm so exciting, because you kind of, you get the general theme and then you get to play. You get to experiment with different things. So from, you know, the Gesneria or the Collyria from the Apicia, and now you mentioned Nautilus calyx, that's a little different for some people. For those that aren't familiar with Nautilus calyx, or the various genera that have been separated into, what are these plants? What do they look like, and where do they come from, and how are you growing them?
Well, they come from America, and if you let me get up in there, let me.
We're getting show and tell. I love it.
This is one. Oh, now I should have groomed this a little bit. Let me just turn it this way.
It's okay.
Here we go. So this is used to be Nautilus calyx panamensis, and now it's Chrysothemis panamensis.
Okay.
It has white flowers. They're very ephemeral. They last hours, not days.
Oh.
They bloom, and they're protandrous, which means male first. Pros first. Tandrous is male. And Nautilus calyx grow from like a caudiciform, not really a tuber, but a caudiciform stem. And so they have a dormant season, and they come back every year. But look at this. It's really, I love the hairs on the leaves.
Yeah.
And they really are very, very tolerant of a lot of neglect. And as you can see, you know, this is the part I was talking. But anyway.
Dangly dry bits there, but.
Dangly dry bits that I should have taken. But this is still Nautilus calyx. This is Nautilus calyx glandulifer.
Smaller, but purplish to the leaves instead of green, but still hairy.
Yes, very hairy. And some people are allergic to this, believe
really?
It or not. Gesnerians are not very, as far as people who have allergies are concerned.
Sure.
You know, the pollen is usually, you know, contained. They don't spread a lot of pollen in the air. But this, I don't know, people find, I'm not allergic to this. And I have, but I have a friend that lives in New Jersey. If she touched this leaf like this, she would break out.
Jeez.
But I've never had any reaction to it. So I think maybe I'm fortunate. That's good that I'm not allergic to my pet.
Yeah, yeah, seriously, that would be really upsetting.
So, but you know, it really, the foliage is really great, and they do have flowers, but they are not very long lasting.
Yeah, that's a really interesting fact, because usually they are showy, I would assume. But that ephemeral nature, it forces you to kind of want to be there, want to appreciate it, and then gives you something to look forward later on. But, you know, you think about what's going on in the wild. Do you have any idea why that would be so advantageous to be so ephemeral? Is there a scent to them that is really attractive? What's going on there?
You know, there are volumes written about just areas and the pollinators.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the reason is. I just know that it is very typical. Now, the ones that are the chrysothemis, well, the ones that have become chrysothemis, do last a little bit longer. I have noticed the difference now that I know what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't last very long. They last maybe 2 or 3 days. Hmm. But they bloom in succession. So there's a lot of blooms. And I think it's just a strategy to... because the rainforest is maybe so rainy that it would ruin the flower.
Yeah.
They probably just have developed this habit of doing a lot of flowers over a longer period of time. Okay. So it just gives a longer average to be pollinated.
No, that makes a lot of sense. If it's going to get damaged, you're probably best to kind of give them over a series of days instead of all at once, when you could ruin a whole reproductive event at once.
Absolutely, like that. Yeah. But some of these things go in very, very damp. I mean, it's, you know, you think Florida's humid.
I never thought heat and humidity bothered me as much until I went to the lowland tropics, and then I realized, oh, I'm actually overheating here. This is bad.
Yeah. I know, yeah. You can sit still and you're just oozing sweat. You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
And the other interesting part, too, to think about is this idea of dormancy. You know, you don't really think about the tropics as having seasons. They do. There's a pronounced dry and wet season. Now, are the dormancy in this group related to water levels, or are they just kind of going to go at random times and then you just kind of ignore them until then?
I think they must be. The caudiciform stem or tuber, I guess really technically it is a tuber, is probably an adaptation to that. So that, if it does go through a little bit of a dry spell, unlike Jasnerias, if you don't water a Jasneria, it would seem like there should be they would have a better defense against a dry spell, but they are completely gone.
Whoops.
Don't work.
So it's this difference between kind of like a storage organ or some sort of storage capacity and not having it.
Right. And probably, you know, maybe Chesnaria hasn't really developed it, or the climate is so even as far as precipitation is concerned that it never needed to develop it.
Yeah.
A lot of the Chesnarias grow in cracks in architecture, like old buildings and things like that. Their roots kind of get down into the cracks of the rocks and get down deep in there. So they do have a good sized root system. So that probably sustains. Where Nautilus calyx grows in like a more of a rainforest environment where it's probably very shallow.
I absolutely adore the fact that you can get all of these insights on how to take care of a plant from just being so intimately involved with this, but then also having that make sense in the context of understanding plants better in the wild. You know, and then something else you mentioned is that when you then started to pay attention and understood which of your plants had jumped genera or changed their taxonomy a little bit, those differences started to make a little bit more sense, right? A little bit more about the biology started to play in. There's something to that.
There is something to that. And I couldn't really articulate that quite as well as you did until really of late. Because I got interested in Asian Jasnerias. The gateway group for that was what used to be Charita, but now is Primulina.
See, that's a group I don't know very well.
Well, let me show you.
Okay.
Primulina is a great species to grow because it has a lot of variety in it. They're all over China and Vietnam and all the Asian peninsula. This is Atropurpurea. And what you can't see on the video, Matt, but what I'd like you to know is that this is very leathery. This is almost like patent leather. It's really quite a cool plant.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's got a kind of a sheen to it. It looks like it could be waxy, but leathery is not what I would have thought. That's impressive.
Yeah, it really is a cool thing. But the Primulina is a large group. Let me show you as a large genre. Let me show you something else. This is a species. This is Fimbrosepala, variegated Fimbrosepala, and you see how hairy this is.
Yeah.
This is really very hairy.
extremely so, not even just fuzzy. It looks like my face after 4 days.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I think that's probably what I like. I don't know. The hairiness is really very attractive. But there's even Thymbrocephalus that are hairier than this.
Really?
They're monstrously hairy, some of them. And
bizarre.
So it's really cool, isn't it? So we were talking about, I was growing them in, you know, like an azalea pot, right?
Uh-huh, kind of deep.
And so I knew that was wrong because when I would unpot them, they were really only growing in the very top inch or two of the soil. So I thought, you know that, I don't need something. So I started growing them in saucers, and then I decided to grow them on plates. This is a plastic recycled plate from the church group. With a hole and I lick it. See, this is how it gets water.
Yeah, yeah.
And you curl the wick around. I discovered that they love this.
I was going to say that it looks like you're growing them on plates, and you literally are. That is so remarkable. What is that substrate? What are you sitting them in?
Well, this is my soil. I use a very inorganic soil. My soil is very simple. It's a half a part of rock wool brocutes, one part perlite and one part vermiculite, and that's it.
Whoa, that's
different. I use it for everything, and I wick everything indoors, and it works outdoors too. And because it's inorganic, I have things that I can grow in this soil mix. I've got an Ascanthus explendidus that's been potted in the same pot for 10 years. Try doing that with a peat-based mix. It'll never
happen. No.
Because the pH descends, especially in Florida, that's what was happening to some of my plants. The pH was descending so quickly because of the heat and the humidity and the breakdown of the peat moss that I was getting terrible fertilizer burn and you know, that lacks up the nutrients, the plant can't absorb it. So I went to something more inorganic. For a long time, I grew things in just plain perlite and vermiculite, but I couldn't keep up with the water. The plant wasn't absorbing all that. It was being wicked up into the air through the air conditioning unit. So I added the rock wool grow cubes, and
awesome.
That's a species, okay?
Okay.
And this is a hybrid. This is Nain Argent. This has got Latifolia dwarf in it, but this is an incredible hybrid.
Oh, wow. That variegation is something to look at.
But anyway, it really is a great species. They have wonderful blue flowers. Let me see if I can find another one.
Okay.
This is another hybrid. This is by my friend and editor of the Gesneria Journal, Peter Shallett. This is his hybrid. This is Loki.
And
I mean, isn't that the coolest thing? That is, that's like a tile floor. I mean, you would spend untold fortune putting tile like that on your floor. And look, grow a plant that has it.
I mean, okay, so just to describe it to those that can't see it, the base of the leaf is, you know, green, but like a deeper green. And then the veins have these broad variegation, silver variegation on them, and then a light downy covering, and then the petioles are almost purple.
They are.
Stunning.
And under really bright light, the petioles become more purple, more pronounced purple. And it has beautiful big blue flowers on long peduncle stems, and they're bell-shaped, and they're beautiful. Okay, so that's a Primulina hybrid. This is another species. This is a recently new to the United States.
Now that's totally different.
look at this leaf. This is Bifinetta pita.
And very different from what I would expect. This almost looks like a watercress leaf versus something more traditional of the Gesneriaceae.
Yes,
that's odd.
But these are all from China, so these are Asian Gesneriaceae. The Asian Gesneriaceae are kind of new to us in the West. And we are just so excited about them because they are totally new. And this is not the only genre. There's other genre, but some of the things that I can show you today, I've got some Petrocosmia, which means rock lutting.
I love Petrocosmia.
Do you?
I do.
It is a wonderful group.
That's
Petrocosmia curiae.
That's huge.
It has white, small white flowers. They bloom in profusion. This really looks very violet-like, but it grows much more symmetrical than a violet. I put this under way too much light. And it has forced it to sucker more than maybe it should. This is the rosette shape that is more typical of Petrocosmia.
Flattened, kind of hugging the ground almost.
Right. It really hugs the rock that it's on because it grows on rock.
Stunning.
This is Periorium.
Nice kind of wrinkled leaves, still hairy.
Still hairy. Now, these two varieties particularly grow well for me here in Florida. Now, not all Petrocosmias do all that well. They like it a little cooler. They like a more temperate climate. You know, we get a little hot for them. But in the air conditioning, these, you know, when you take these to sale, it has to be in a cool month in Florida. Because in the summertime, when it's like almost 100 degrees and it's very humid, these kind of melt almost like what candle wax. They really just, they just totally disintegrate. You know, that
tragic.
Yeah, it is. It is tragic. It almost disintegrates. And then coming back to America, the thing that I got interested in was Syningia speciosa, which was formerly known as Glaxinia, but this is the true Glaxinia now. This is
weird.
This has these beautiful little white flowers. Yeah. This is actually a true Glaxinia. There's only a few Glaxinia species. This is Glaxinia arenoides, red satin. And it, if I can get this leaf into the camera, you can see that this has spots. It looks like mealybugs.
Yeah.
It's not. It's just spotted.
Oh, I get so paranoid looking at that. I feel, oh, no.
Yeah. People have taken it to judging and had it refused because, but
there's no don't bring your diseases in here. Yeah.
It's just the way it is. And it has these wonderful little sprays, and I can hardly keep these things off of here. These wonderful sprays of little, what is very typical Gessneria flora. It's, you know, it's bilabial and it's five petals and very typical. So then,
gorgeous, white and red.
White and red. And this is. I think that's really why this is called red satin, because it has the red upper lip. There's a lot of hybridizing going on with Coleria. This is an old Coleria hybrid. This is maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 years old. This is, now I'm going to have to get reminded of the name of it, because I know its name as well as my own. It's Gigi's Lava Land. It really is an incredible flower.
Yes, that is. Pink tube. It's a tubular flower. Pink tube.
And the yellow, almost concolor green lobes. And those beautiful kind of almost really dark burgundy or mahogany spots in the lower petals are just incredible. And this is a very floriferous variety, but it grows monstrously tall. And most people don't like to grow these, but I like, you know, Matt, I'm one of these strange people that like to grow big things. I'm not intimidated by big things at all. So I
bring it on.
It's all right. But there are other Colarias that are equally as interesting, maybe not quite so big. This is a Florida hybridizer has hybridized this wonderful thing. This is Florida Freckle.
I like that. Also very kind of almost more red than highlighter pink, but still pink.
The background of the limb is really white. The petals are white with red spots. Very unusual. Very beautiful color. Very, really compact grower. See, this has gotten really long. But this
jumping up.
Yeah, it's trying to get to another pot, probably. But these are rhizomatous. So these have rhizomes. And they look like, let's see if I can pick this up. The rhizomes, you know, are really specialized leaves and stems, right? And they look just like little worms. But see, if I get this a little closer,
okay,
you can see that it is really specialized leaves on a stem. And you can grow, you can descale this. These are little scale, these kind of rhizomes are called scales. You can descale them and you can start these and they come back a little faster than from seed.
No way.
And you can also start them from a rhizome just maybe a quarter of an inch long.
Huh.
So, you know, the ease of propagation is really a great thing. It helps out when you can't always get the best culture.
Now, the plants you just showed me, though, for the average listener, do you need the Florida-type humidity conditions to grow these? You mentioned the Petrocosmias are okay with a little cooler conditions. Some need more humidity. Of the ones you just showed me, are these accessible plants for most people?
Yes. The most popular genres, I think, to grow in Gessneriaceae are Syningias, Colarias, and probably in the north it might be Petrocosmias, but in a more southern climate, it would probably, in more humidity, it would probably be Apicius.
Okay.
And there's a lot of hybridizing going on with those groups. And there are hybridizing groups that are dedicated just to certain genera. The people in Turkey love Polarias. They absolutely are crazy about them. They're hybridizing them like they're going out of style. And they have come up with some great things. The people in Sweden hybridize them. So, see, you know, that's in the Arctic Circle. the people in the Ukraine hybridize them. It's very accessible to everybody. And syringes are one of those ones that you can grow them in a wide range of conditions.
That's good to know, because these are so gorgeous and just have so much for just conversation starting or giving multiple, if you like flowers, if you like foliage, there's just so much for different people to get to know and love these plants. And again, anything that can bring people closer to plants is something that should be cherished and specialized. Yes. And this is such a great group by the sounds of it. And then there's just something for everyone. You weren't joking when you said
no,
that.
No, I'm not. And you know, I have to tell you that I come from that tradition. I have learned from my Jesneria friends that they are the most generous, the most giving people that I have ever met. They will bring a stunning, you know, award-winning show plant to show, and they will, at the end of the show, cut it apart till it looks like you ran it over with a lawnmower, giving pieces away to people, because they really want people to grow them. I mean, they generally, you know, I sometimes have noticed in other societies that I've been in, people will say they would like you to grow it, but they really, they'll give you a piece and you'll think, really, did you really want me to have this? You know, they might just have a piece of, you know, that they ripped off with their fingers. Yeah. But the Jesneria people are very, very generous, and they love to give the, you know, share their plants and their love of growing. And that's what I really like about, that's what I really I found very good.
That's how you keep societies and plants and all of these things
that's
alive,
right,
is by spreading it to people, getting new people involved. And I've really come to appreciate that more in recent years, because I think a lot of times botany, conservation, ecology are on one side and horticulture and hobby growing are on the other, when in reality, the two really need to be in the same room together. Because how often is it that you hear, we don't have enough time and money to conserve all of these species? Well, guess who does have a lot of time and a lot of money? Growers and collectors. Now, I'm not saying wantonly go out and grab endangered species out of the wild, but sometimes the only way these plants are kept alive and kept in any sort of numbers and saved from these mass apocalyptic events is by having multiple people growing them all over the world.
And the conservation issues really are really, it's unfortunate, but they're starting to change now. They're starting to change up a little bit. But it's impossible sometimes to import some of these things, because they are basing it on the animal kingdom. You don't want to import 25 rhinos into zoos among the United States when there's maybe 150 left in the wild. But plants are really different, because they are so easily propagated, and there's seed, and there are things that you can do to keep them alive. But I agree with you, Matt. There are conservation growers that really grow a wide, not now, I have a friend here in North in Zephyr Hills, Nancy Kest. I call her my Jesneria mom, because she kind of took me under her wing. But, you know, she has a conservation collection of like 500 species in many different genera. It doesn't matter how well they bloom. It doesn't matter if they go to show and she wins an award with them, which she does win. She's a really great grower. She's an incredible grower. But she grows all this stuff, and I have another friend that lives in Lakeland, not very far from me, Kelly Ates, who grows a big conservation collection of all these things, and they grow them specifically because they're unusual, they want to preserve them, and they just love them. They just love them. And so botanists have to cultivate us horticulture people, and they have to be a little bit easy on us when we ask, you know, that I think they should be a little more open to the idea. A lot of them are, and I'm not saying that they're not. But when you have something really rare and difficult for home culture, I think sometimes they're a little reluctant to let people have it. But I think they should try, because you just never know what you might be able to grow. I mean, I have a friend, Mike Riley, in New York, who grows things he should not be able to grow in his New York apartment. He shouldn't be grows things on. You should see the things he goes through to try to keep these. I mean, he does just incredible things. He's got a rock garden on his roof.
Yeah.
He's got a wall in his living room. And, you know, he grows all this kind of stuff and absolutely loves it. He's been on collecting trips, which I have not. I need to go sometime. But you really need to get and people who are enthusiastic about growing these plants involved. And the more they know, the more precious they know it is. And the more they're going to do well to propagate it, get it out to other growers to keep it going. So things do wax and wane in popularity, but I do tend to hang on to things a long time. And I've got plants in my collection that are, it's hard to believe, but they're like 15 years old.
Oh, I completely. I mean, I've got hand-me-downs from my great-grandfather. Yeah. Plants can live an extremely long time. And again, it's a shame with when he passed away, most of his plants were lost. And if there was something special in that collection, it's gone. To know that that happens very frequently, this is why, again, kind of opening the doors, being communicative and finding these societies that are open and willing to share and people that want to teach you, that's so vital.
That is. And there's something else that's kind of vital, too, that we don't really think about. And I'm starting to give more thought to it as I get older. But Matt, we need to, those of us who have amassed large collections, really need to leave them to someone. Because the next group we're going to talk about that I've got some things to show you from are syningas. And syninga tubers are like parrots. They will outlive you. They will last longer than you do. They can be over 100 years old, no problem. Without much soil, without much, you know, in the wild, they grow in rocky stuff. They kind of wrench themselves into the, you know, the little niche in the cliff, you know, and they
nooks and crannies,
and they bloom and grow happily for scores and scores of years. Okay, so now that I've done that great segue, here, watch this. This is
this is perfect. I love this.
This is Syningia bulleti. This is, there are very few plants that have this kind of bullate leaf. This is a very rare thing in the plant world. But, you know, a bullate leaf is a leaf that is so heavily quilted that it becomes kind of pebbly. It's quilted to the extreme.
Yeah.
And this is one of these things that has wonderful hairs. This is actually white hairs, if I could get it closer to the camera.
Yeah. Oh, it's, I can see it. It's like you go from green just to pure white sheen.
Yeah. And this is, now the hair is better inside where it's drier. But this is a great, it has these wonderful orange flowers with spots. I thought it was a Coleria when I first saw it, but it's not a Coleria at all. Because, in fact, it does have a tuber. See, right?
Oh, right there. Look at that. A nice woody base to it. It's almost so stark. You get these fleshy stems coming out of what looks like a wood rock.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. It is very woody. They give a little bit. They have a little bit of give. But this is one of those ones that went through a name change. It was Florianopolis, but now it's properly reclassified as Bulleta. It's really a great plant to use in hybridizing because it lends its progeny this, not necessarily the bulleteness, but it gives it really great foliage and these wonderful spots in the flowers.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. I love
it. It's great. All right. So that is one type of syningia, but there are others. There's, you know, this is a Mambeensis. This is a very happy plant. Mm. This is a plant that will grow in a wide variety of conditions, humid or not, cool or hot. This grows out on my back porch in 90-degree weather and blooms beautifully. It has it's never naked. It has blooms on it almost all the time. It's just incredible.
Wow.
It's very hard to take to show because this is very hairy surface, and it just collects everything, every little piece of perlite, every little pollen, its own pollen. So it's very hard to take show because you'll have 100 flowers and they've dropped pollen on the leaves, and then try to get that off with a brush. You know, it's like, oh my god, it's like your worst nightmare. It's like the Twilight Zone trying to get ready for show. So that's.
And with my luck, I get some off and then bump and dust more on another one.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. And then you break something off, which is the worst thing. But this is the kind that I like to grow. This is my hybrid. This is Syningia speciosa. It was Florus glaxinia, but it's now been reclassified as a true Syningia. They have tubers, but this is Treasures of Darkness. I love this because it has a true slipper-shaped flower, which is really an advanced adaptation. The older Gesnerian flowers are, you know, have five petals, right? And they are very flat, you know, like an Elsobia. It's a very old flower. But these syningias, this is a more recent adaptation with the slipper shape. But it still retains the species slipper shape, but it has more petals. It has six, if you'll notice.
Oh, yeah. They're almost petunia in how big and
purple
they are.
Oh, yeah. And they get,
it's amazing.
And believe it or not, they get bigger than this. But this is really just a great.
No way.
Yeah, they can be over 4.5 inches. Over, no problem. And but there's a sacrifice because this is how big the plant is. Rather than my shoulder. Okay?
That's not for the small shelf in the corner. Yeah. You got it. You said it yourself, though. You're not daunted.
No, I am not at all intimidated by big things. And I just love to grow big things.
So this is interesting to think about, because I don't generally think about hybridization. You know, I deal mostly with species stuff, but the fact that you can do all of this hybridization says a lot about these different genera. There's a lot of openness, and I had an evolution professor that always would scoff at, plants can do whatever they want, you can get a new species overnight. So there's a lot of versatility with that. But then just the versatility in what you can produce. Like you said, you produce, like, solid colors, you're from that, but then people can use hybrids and make all of these spots. What is it about hybridization that attracts you? How do you do it? And it's just always amazing to me that you can look at something and go, I have an idea of what I want to create. Let's do that. What's that process
like? You know, I think it is, I have come by this really late. I really started hybridizing only in 2014. I watched a lot of hybridizers and what they were doing and the results for a long time before I started. I think you have to reach a point in your life where you just want to get in there and do it. And I just wanted to get in there and do it. And so I did. And it's such an encouraging hobby. You know, it's the best kind of game. I always say it, I compare it to gambling. You know, it's the best kind of gambling in the world. Because even if you roll the genetic dice and you come up with a dud, you've learned something. And, you know, that sure. Dud can be beautiful to you. But you learn after a while, you learn that it's maybe not so great. But I think you just get the people who dream about new flowers that are not yet known. If I combine this trait with this trait and see if I can get like an orange flower with no spots or an orange flower with pink spots, people dream about that kind of stuff and they can achieve it. It's remarkable how easy it is to achieve. You know, sometimes within two or three generations, you can produce something that you might have thought was impossible. So it's really very rewarding. It's so exciting. Oh my God. Once I started hybridizing, I stopped buying plants because my house is full of hybrids. And
yeah, you know, I can imagine it takes up a bit more room. Not a problem, though. I mean, it saves your wallet.
Yeah, I'm rolling it. Plants are dollars.
No, and that's something interesting to think about because, again, it's not something I've considered. I don't dabble in it myself. I propagate only to make more for friends, but I don't get into it to create, at least not yet. And you had sent me an article and I read it and it gave me a really interesting perspective on the subject because it's, again, it's not something I dabble in. So to hear a person's perspective on it, someone like yourself that's had an intimate relationship with these plants for some time, and then this idea, like you said, of thinking of things that haven't been created yet. And that's when it kind of clicked for me. I went, oh, so there's this deeper level of looking at an appreciation with these plants and then knowing it's capable to mix and match. And like you said, you're rolling the genetic dice. That's got to be a whole new exciting way of appreciating these plants you've fallen in love
with. It's what wakes me up in the morning and keeps me going all day. I absolutely love it. It's a whole new day for me when I started hybridizing. And it's something to look forward to, and it makes you a better grower in that you become used to handling seed, learn to grow seedlings from seed to, you know, maturity and eventually flowering them. And once in a while, you get something really great. Just one. All you need is one. And it's just the thrill of a lifetime. And I think you should have a thrill of a lifetime every day.
And with plants, that's possible, right?
Yes, it is.
No, and that's great. And especially from the learning aspects, anything that gets people involved, anything that makes people better growers, and again, it then expands into every walk of horticulture that you potentially can have. That's such an interesting perspective to take
on. And it expands into your life in other ways. I think you understand that everything in life needs to be tended and nurtured. And you become consistent in not letting the weeds grow up among your dreams. So you see, it really extends as far as you'd like it, as far as you can imagine. That's how far I could go.
Yeah. You know, I really never believed that meditation was a thing for me until I started botanizing, getting into botany and hiking and looking for plants and then growing plants, especially that peace of mind you get and the patience you learn and this kind of artistry of the routine. And like you said, this learning to tend for something, you learn a lot, not only about the plants and the organisms, but about the world and about yourself. And that's something more people.
Yeah, need. I think that's true. I think more people, you know, today, most plant societies, I've been involved with quite a few of them, the numbers are shrinking because the new generation is very impatient and they don't really want to put a lot of time in. They haven't been taught to nurture things and to be consistent about it. I think it's a very important thing to learn for yourself because, you know, when you have your own children, you're going to need to nurture them. And if you have a relationship with your spouse, you're going to have to nurture that. You know, everything needs that kind of... Gardening is a metaphor for a lot of things. And so I think that it's really important. You know, I had an art professor who said, you know, we should never stop teaching kids how to draw. You know, we teach them how to draw and color in kindergarten, and then we stop. And then we teach them a lot of other things. But he said that artistic expression and the need to express yourself in a disciplined way is really very essential to becoming a success at almost anything. So, but I would love to get more young people interested in plants. And I think it's a great hobby. You don't need a lot of space. You don't need a lot of anything.
Yeah.
You know, you just can do it and work with the conditions you have and be very happy with it. So.
Well, I think in this conversation, you have lit a fire under someone's butt, hopefully multiple people's butt, to get into this. Because, again, it's easy. Like you said, there's something for everyone, and people are willing to share. People like yourself have a lot of information to give out, a lot of plants to talk about, and you know, it's an inspiration. And I'm really happy you sat down and talked with us today. In the interest of time, you know, you've got a lot of stuff going on. The Gesneriad Society's got a lot of stuff going on. If people want to find out more, how do they find out more? How do they start getting into this?
The JesneriadSociety.org is our website. You can Google the Gesneriad Society and come up with the website. Most of the website is free to anyone who gets there. The Gesneriad Reference Web by Ron Meyer is newly revamped. That is free, a free website. You can go there and learn about how to care for Gesneriads in the wonderful world. As deep as you want to go, there's scholarly articles, there's pictures, there's care, and he's expanded it tremendously, and it's very user-friendly. When you become a member of the society, then there's a member site that gives you access to our seed fund, which is very important, you know, because if you want to grow a rare species from South America, Brazil, wherever, you can get some seed, and you can start your own plant. There's the journal. Oh, my God, there's the journal that's published 4 times a year. The journal has just incredible articles. And so the Gesneriad Convention is what's coming up. It's coming up the week of July 4th. It always is July 4th week, no matter. We have it in different parts of the country. We try to do East Coast 1 year, West Coast another year, you know, North and South. It's coming up probably the 1st through the 7th. Wonderful. Is going to be the dates. If you're in the area of Framingham, it's a suburb of Boston, please come and join us. You can. The showroom is open for free. You don't have to be a member to come and see the show. It is some of the most fantastic growing you'll ever see. It's just incredible. It's a week-long, jam-packed, never get a moment to yourself a piece of excitement. It's just really great. You should run, not walk, to the nearest convention because it really is
wonderful.
And I hope you'll be.
I would love to. Jay, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us. I think everyone really appreciates your insights. And I think, like I said, I hope you've lit the fire under someone's butt to get involved and just start growing these great plants.
Just do it.
All right. Thank you and have a great day.
All right, Matt. You too.
There really is a Gesneriad for everyone. I've taken a stab at growing a handful of these plants over the years. Sometimes that's been successful, other times it's ended in failure, but it's always been a learning curve, and I think you can hear in Jay's passion for these plants that it's well worth it when you finally get it figured out for at least a handful of these genera. I wish you could have seen some of the plants he was showing me, but that's all the more reason to go check out the Gesneriad Society's webpage, and if you're in the eastern United States, specifically around the Massachusetts area, July 3rd through the 7th is the Gesneriad Society's convention. It sounds like you can go there and see some incredible plants and even walk away with a few plants of your own. Not to mention, by the sounds of it, everyone is super welcoming and it's a great group of growers, but I just, again, want to focus in on the passion that Jay has for these plants, and you can tell that it really brings something to his life. And then to give back to the community of growers, and even as he mentioned with these conservation collections, it's just a wonderful group of people to get to know. And I really thank him for taking the time to talk with us. Before I leave, I just want to say, if you're enjoying this podcast and you'd like to support it, please consider reviewing it on whatever podcatcher you use to download it, and while you're there, hit subscribe. Also, stickers for sale, indefenseofplants.com/shop. Head on over there, check out all of the new sticker designs by Tom Pearson, and also make sure you pick up the In Defense of Plants logo sticker, because 50% of every one of those stickers we sell gets donated to the North American Orchid Conservation Center, so it's for a good cause. All right, as always, I've got a lot of great interviews coming up in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned. And the best way to do that is to click that subscribe button. Thanks for listening, everyone. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.
This episode was produced in part by Philip, Henriette, Letitia, Ron, Tim, Carl, Lisa, Anthony, Susanna, Homestead Brooklyn, Brody, Kevin, Katharina, Sophia, Lisa, Brent, Plant by Design, Mark, Renz, Mountain Misery Farms, Bendix, Aaron A., Holly, Clipton, Shane, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, and Margie.